what I do is I visualize failure a lot. That's how I made all the hard decisions in my life. When we started doing the startup thing, everybody was talking to us about the best problems you can have is something that you can fail quickly in, right? Find something that you know in a couple of months whether you're doing a good job of. And we went completely the other way. You gotta be confident. Mm-hmm. That goes through more, I would argue, than your actual pitch. The biggest funds had smaller term sheets. We were not quite sure where we should put our team slide, right? I mean, should we like put a lot of emphasis on it? Should we talk more about the product than ourselves? And one thing we got as a feedback from, look, I mean, you gotta talk about yourself. You gotta prop yourself up. Like the aura around fundraising, it needs to go down a little bit, because right now, first of all, if you are a bootstrapped company and you've never even had to take financing, that's much better than securing a $100 million investment. I hate failing so much that it actually charges me. We got to talk about the bad times of the successful case. So we got to talk about the people that just didn't quite make it, because there is a huge amount of chance in all of this. And I really appreciate when somebody, there was this great interview by Mark Cuban, he said, look, same guy, same education, same skills. If I was born 2 years earlier, I wouldn't have any success.
This podcast episode is supported by EBRD. Support to small and medium-sized businesses is an important part of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development's mandate. Activities to support small businesses include direct and indirect financing through partner institutions. The EBRD's Advice for Small Businesses team provides the knowledge, the network, and the skills to help emerging businesses innovate, thrive, and succeed.
Hello, Recursive community. Our next guest believes that entrepreneurship is the coolest job in the world. Milan Manev is the co-founder and CTO of Plan Delta, a next-generation planning tool bridging the gap between strategic and financial planning. With over 20 years of experience in the IT industry, Milan has a wealth of knowledge in software development and has held various leadership positions, including vice president at the American software company, Sync HR. Milan, I'm very happy that you're here.
Same here.
The background of software and actually product development is probably laying a wonderful foundation for this venture that you have started recently with your co-founder, Martin.
Yeah, it's been something that I have a technical background, but I've always thought myself more of a problem solver person. Mm. And obviously technology is the way you do it, but it's more of a tool. The goal is to have a challenge and then find a way to fix it, and fix it in the most efficient, most useful to the user's way. So this has been part of my work throughout this, and this has been an excellent preparation for any startup career I ended up eventually in. So solving problems, I think, is at the core of what entrepreneurship is really about.
And still, the problem that you're currently solving is a complex one. And it requires, I guess, also a lot of background knowledge and experience when it comes to finance and how the finances of a company are being organized and structured and help you steer the company in the future. And in this sense, I was just wondering, what fascinated you about this kind of problem? Why?
I'll take you one step backwards. I mean, when we started doing the startup thing, everybody was talking to us about the best problems you can have is something that you can fail quickly in, right? Find something that you know in a couple of months whether you're doing a good job of. And we went completely the other way. So we started something that we knew that it's going to be like a 3-year period until we even know if we are on the right track. It's incredibly complex. There are very few people that understand it. When you're pitching to VC, you got to give this huge intro about what you're doing, which was not ideal. But we didn't go, some entrepreneurs approach the field in which they're going to work by saying, okay, what is the biggest potential market that I can address? And let me find a problem in that market so that I have a potentially big customer base. We did the opposite. We got really interested in the idea of financial planning, analysis, consolidation, all those problems in the space. And then it eventually ended up that it's a pretty big space, but we didn't start by targeting the big space. We just liked the idea, got really excited about it. My partner Martin has been living this pain for 10 years because he has CFO background. I had an idea how to solve it, because if you give me a problem, that's what I jumped to. I said, oh, this can be solved this way. And we started working on it. Great news was, when we started going out to the market, understanding how big the problem is, it turned out it's a really big problem. And it was really exciting because it was one of the first big business systems that were developed were in the space, and they are now 30 years old. So it was a great opportunity for a new breed of systems to enter that market, disrupt it, do it in a more modern, more efficient way. But everybody that we talked to knew what the possibility was. So it's actually pretty a good place we ended up. But we didn't like plan to get there. It was just that. Mm-hmm. So it happened. It was a good coincidence of events.
I wonder, which are the tools and what is the methodology to understand if you're solving a big problem in the startup world? How did you know that it's one?
I mean, there are several. I can tell you how we knew. So when we were doing our last fundraising round, we got approached. Like, literally, I mean, our current investors opened a lot of doors for us, and it was super useful. But when we started meeting with companies, the interest we got from, like, the class A VCs of the world was enormous. And they knew that we are at too early stage for them to invest in us, right? But they still wanted to know what we're doing, what our approach to it. They wanted to keep an eye on us. So that was a huge validation, because they wanted to know mm-hmm. what was going on. They wanted to be in a position to potentially invest. And we talked with companies like Sequoia, like Index, like Andreessen Horowitz, et cetera. So everybody that we kind of at some point dreamed about potentially investing in us, we had a chance to actually meet and talk to them. So that was a great validation. Obviously, the second part of the validation comes from the people that are your clients and how painful their life is. We are joking that we are trying to incite excitement in accountants. That's what we do, which is not an easy task. we were able to pretty quickly identify a lot of pain points that were pretty big and attack them. So obviously clients is one good way to do it, but the interest of the VC and the investors is actually pretty good indicators, because those people know where the potential for a big hit is.
Okay, that's interesting. And how did you, what kind of process did you go with accountants to figure out which problems need actually solving? Because I can imagine that they are also creatures of habit, and they're used to doing certain things in
more
a certain
so than
way,
others,
and probably more so than others. So why touch a running system?
First of all, we had the luxury of having somebody from the other side of the fence, because Martin has lived in those shoes for a long time, and that helps, because he can like literally quote problems and the amount of time it takes. So creatures of habit are creatures of habit, but if something is painful, if something's causing you to be inefficient, you always know that. It's an impediment to your business. And obviously, as with any business, you have the early adopters who are the first to go over the fence, right? Mm-hmm. And those are the people that we're looking for. So we are not probably at the moment addressing the run-of-the-mill general accounting population. We are looking at people that are visionaries. We are looking at people that are trying to expand the boundaries of what they do. And once we get those guys converted, the rest will fall. Eventually, you will, having a tool like ours will become the norm rather than the exception, and then everybody will get on with the program. But we're looking for people that are obviously doing it, but are always looking for better ways to do it. Mm-hmm. And then once we see, we can show the improvement that we can do, it's much easier for others to follow suit, and we can give them the good examples.
Great.
So converting the general population is probably going to be the next step of the process, but we are now pretty happy with the way we are with the early adopters and the guys that are a little bit more open to the new things.
I guess in the meanwhile, you also needed to follow a process where you are part of a system which is actually very complex, and there are also other IT systems that are solving certain parts of the problem. So you needed to figure out your own niche where you're going to be better than the others, right? So how did you identify exactly this focus?
This is a great question. We did that super early on. We did it probably in the first 3-4 months when we started this. We drew a diagram of pretty much every system that's in play in a company of the size that we are tackling. And we did this kind of exercise when we're saying, this is a system that we're going to work together with. This is a system that we want to displace. Mm-hmm. This is a system that we are augmenting, right? So we're trying to say, where are we going to fit in the picture? Because obviously, if you're sitting on top of systems, if you're working well with systems, that makes your adoption much easier, right? Instead of you say, oh, you got to throw out your entire infrastructure and we're going to replace it, that's very scary. And you have multiple systems that have different business owners. Yeah. So now you got to convince a whole bunch of people. But if you say, hey, we're going to plug into whatever you have, we're going to leave in place 90% of what you're having, we're going to work well with those systems, but we're going to augment those pieces, maybe drop a little bit of tools here and there, but overall maintain the same structure, it's a much more easier entry, right? Mm-hmm. And we are actually able to do that because we are not asking people to replace their accounting systems. We are not asking to replace the HR systems. We are saying, hey, whatever you have, we'll work with it. We even made it a pretty good point of making sure that we work very well with a very wide variety of source systems. And actually coming from Bulgaria, this was a pretty unique opportunity because like in UK or the US, like systems like QuickBooks are so prevalent that if you're working well with them, you don't need to worry about much else. Bulgaria has about 35 accounting software. Some of them are from the 70s, right? And we said, okay, we got to find a way to have an approach to working with all of them. And technologically, it was very challenging, but we ended up in a pretty great place because we say, look, I mean, if you're an international company, we don't care if your offices are in the US, UK, Bulgaria, Burkina Faso, anywhere, right? We have a system that's flexible enough to pull that data in. And that's a very strong message because it's not uncommon for companies in a very early stage to be working in 3-4 legal entities across different countries. Mm-hmm. And by having that flexibility, the fact that we're telling them you don't have to give up or change your accounting structure underneath, it makes it much easier for us to run towards adoption.
I wonder, from this perspective, why did it make sense for you to initiate the product market fit process for Bulgaria in this case?
Fair question. Yeah. It's always easier to start your early adopters with your network.
Yeah.
You got to stop it at some point. Every time I speak with people that are starting their journey, I say, don't put too much stress on the clients you can get from your network, right? Unless your software or your product is something that you can sell to 10 people and that'll be it. The sooner you move away from that, the better. But obviously in the beginning, it's much easier. For us, it was great because even though like US, UK is a pretty uniform market, the EU is not. The EU, every country has a predominant product. Mm-hmm. So by virtue of us being able to work with that, it makes it much easier for us to address the EU market. And that's why we are addressing the EU first, because our value prop is much more aligned there and we can hit stronger in that space.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you also decided to maybe focus on in a certain segment of the market, like, small, medium enterprise businesses, or maybe certain industries, because I can imagine that strategic planning can be different in the different segments of the market, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So it's not that hard for us to determine that because you got to have a certain amount of complexity for our system to actually make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. If you're a mom and pop shop, if you're a very small company, your financials are too simple to have the need for a powerful tool to do it. On the upper side, I mean, feature-wise, we are not ready to necessarily address the biggest enterprises. So we are at the moment in this upper middle tier of company that are probably in their scale up stage, Series A, Series B.
Okay.
And obviously we want to move upwards. We want to be able to do the enterprise too. We know that we have some work to do feature wise to get there. But in terms of industries, I mean, we have the example of, we call it the shoe factory. So if you have a business that's very predictable, that doesn't have a lot of disruptions, that doesn't have a lot of dynamicism in it, you are probably fine. Right. Mm-hmm. Things are not changing quickly enough for you to lose grasp financially of what's happening. But if you're moving quickly, you mm-hmm. need to have very, very accurate information of where we are. if you're getting affected by the market too much, you need to get that information really quickly. If you're a startup and you have that sprint towards the next round, et cetera, where your financials are, you got to have a very good grasp. So I think from pretty early on, we had a pretty good picture of who the ideal customers are, both mm-hmm. in terms of size and in terms of industry.
I wonder also something else, because my experience was a bit more in this data warehouse automation space. Mm-hmm. And you can build wonderful solutions and wonderful visualizations when it comes to data, but in the end, it all comes to the data that you're feeding it yeah. with. And in the case of fast moving, probably even startup companies, I can imagine that this process can be also challenging, like, you know, the accounting process that is actually, you know, gathering the data of the past.
Yeah.
And I guess you can feed it in the system, but how do you control that, you know, what has been fed is giving you a solid foundation to make decisions?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, we are, with accounting data, a month is probably the frequency that is, you probably cannot get much lower than that.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out it's pretty good, because if you ask, and I did that exercise, I went to companies that I know and said, look, I mean, what's the latest financial data from your company that you got? How old was it that mm-hmm. you last got it? And there were people that got it 3 months ago. There are people that haven't gotten anything in 2 years. They have a general feel of where it is. They know that they're making some money. And I was actually surprised by the number of people that didn't have direct up-to-date access to that data. It's very rare. So monthly is decent. It's better than like 95% of the market has.
Okay.
We are trying to obviously think of ways to do it better, but until we move from the accounting data to like more lower level tiers, maybe connect to ERPs, et cetera, it's probably not going to get much better than that, but that's good. For the next 5 to 10 years, I think it's still decent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Decent responsiveness.
Okay. Now, you mentioned in the beginning that you managed to talk to one of the most craved for VC funds in the world. Did that make your job in the fundraising part easier? Although maybe at this point it was too early for them to invest mm-hmm. in Plant Delta, you still had a feeling at least of the dynamics. What is the conversation? What kind of, you know, questions are, you know, investors going to ask you? How do they think mm-hmm. about stuff? So when you then return to the early stage investors who are ready to invest in Plant Delta already in the at this stage of development, were the conversations easier?
Uh-huh.
And then I have a trick question.
Sure.
Was there a sort of disappointment when you started talking to maybe investors who are less experienced, less competent? Mm. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe you could make a comparison.
That's a fair question.
Yeah.
It definitely helps in terms of your self-esteem.
Right? Okay.
And it's I can't underestimate the importance of that, because you gotta look at the top of your game. You gotta be confident.
Mm-hmm.
That goes through more, I would argue, than your actual pitch, because what we're pitching is probably not understandable to 90% of the people unless they had some previous experience in that space. Any detail about what we're actually doing is lost on them by and large. I mean, people focus a lot on like the addressable market, on the opportunity, right? How fast can we get there? The team, stuff like that, that's easy to evaluate, but not necessarily how technically proficient your product is or the details mm-hmm. of the value prop, because you don't even know how good they are, let alone those guys. But what you can easily tell is, are those people excited? Are those people motivated? Are those people self-assured? Do they believe that they can do it? And I think that's probably one of the most impactful results of us meeting with those companies, because we said, okay, well, we are talking to some of the real hard hitters of this world. So we are doing something right. Mm-hmm. And it helps from that standpoint. Otherwise, I think just the sheer number of how many pitching calls you make is very useful. You don't want to be in a position to have like just two with like your top two prospects. I literally advise somebody to just find funds that you literally wouldn't take the money of, but just have some meetings so that you can hone your pitch get that initial stress out of your system. By the time we did maybe 45 pitch sessions with different companies, by the end we were like a well-oiled machine. So everybody knew exactly what they were saying. We took out the best bits of our pitch. We took out the things that were not working very well. So we felt really confident. And actually the fund that did invest in us, they came up relatively later in the process. And I think part of the reason we were able to land that deal was because we were very, very well structured in that that process. So that is literally, we have recordings of the early one. And it's horrible. So we look at that and said, I wouldn't give myself money with that pitch. So you got to do it. It's with everything. You get better as you do more and more of it. So that was also very useful. We had, and again, we were very thankful to 11, who was our early investors, that they were able to do a whole lot of, open a lot of doors for us and give us an opportunity to talk to a lot of people. Because I'm sure if we literally had like just two interviews, we never could have landed. We just wouldn't have done a good pitch, wouldn't have presented our product.
Okay. And is there a difference in the mindset of the big global VCs, the tier one VCs, and I don't know, those that you would talk to, you know, on a local level, who are like the early stage investors usually?
It's weird, but it's a lot more laid back with some of the bigger ones, because they, I mean, with some of the smaller ones, we used to talk a lot about some very small details that were, I don't believe, were particularly important. One of the things we did was we asked pretty much everybody that we talked to that was willing to do it to send us what their term sheet looks like, right? Because we didn't know, right? I mean, we haven't seen a lot of them. We said, hey, can you send us what your term sheet looks like? And we got a bunch. We got probably about a dozen at least. Some people said we can, but...
That's an interesting collection.
The biggest funds had small term sheets. They had very little detail in the term sheets. Some of the smaller funds had those like 35 pages term sheets. That was like it's like your mobile network contract that has a lot of like tricky legal language in it, etc. Sequoia's term sheet was literally a one pager, like maybe two, and was very up to the point. So that was very interesting to me. I mean, it was, their focus was completely elsewhere. The focus was more on the value of what they're getting, which I think is right, because it matters most.
Okay. So if you had to maybe extract 2 to 3 tips that you can give to founders when they initiate the conversation with the top tier VC, because I think this is something that happens rarely for to companies which are from our part of the world, but what would be the top three tips here?
I'll try to go with something that's not necessarily, there are probably more important things, but I'll go with some things that are probably not that obvious, right? The first thing was, don't be, and this is probably more typical for Eastern European VCs than anywhere else, that's at least what they told us. We were not quite sure where we should put our team slide, right? I mean, should we like put a lot of emphasis on it? Should we talk more about the product than ourselves? And one thing we got as a feedback from, look, I mean, you got to talk about yourself. You got to prop yourself up. Don't be, this is not the place to be timid and, oh, I'm so, I don't want to talk about myself. On the contrary, you got to like reach out, find everything you are selling yourself to a big extent and make that front and center. Because especially if it's an early stage investor, that's what they're investing in. They're investing in this group of people. So you shouldn't be skittish about like putting an emphasis and saying what you're good at. And this took a little bit of work for us because we had our team slides almost last. We were like just very, it was like a CV. I worked here, I did that. And then we talked with some people. We were able to get some really honest conversation about it. They said, look, I mean, put that up front. Find stuff in your past that you are proud of that will be good looking on instead of saying, okay, that's an extraordinary person. They can bring something to the table that we didn't. Then I reached back and like in 10th grade, I went to a Mensa IQ test and got a pretty good result. I said, put it in. It's relevant. And I was like, okay, I wouldn't naturally do that, but it's you shouldn't be, on the contrary, you should push that as hard as you can. So that is, I think, important. What else? I think, I don't know if it's a good practice in general, but it's a good practice for me, is to be fair about what you know and what you don't know. Because sometimes they'll ask yourself, what are your sales going to be in 2 years? And if somebody can tell you what your sales are going to be in 2 years, good luck with them. And nobody does, right? And I can speak because, like, sales is not my thing. I'm a technical guy. So if you ask me about any technical questions, can you build it? What are the challenges there? I can talk to you for 5 hours. But I'm not going to pretend that I know what a pipeline feel and, like, conversion percentages look like. So I think being fair about what you're good at and what you're not good at, I don't see how that can harm, right? I mean, pretending that you know stuff that you don't is probably more harm than good. And then you got to be confident.
I always wondered how investors actually evaluate this kind of honesty. I think it's important for a founder to be able to reflect on the things that they are not good at. And they have blind spots, and to be open about it and say, actually, I do know that I have a deficiency, and right now I don't necessarily have the solution, but I'm working on it. You know, I've realized that there is a problem, and so on and so forth. So I really hope that this kind of honesty can be rather nurtured, because on the long run, this is what you need as a leader in a company. This is what you need as a professional also in a company. You need to know what you're not good at and focus on the things that you're providing the most value.
It depends on what you're looking for, right? I mean, I have a friend that's a car salesman. And I asked the question, like, how are you not faced by the fact that you're lying every day to people about, like, the mileage of their cars and who drove it, right? Because they do it. They go and they said, no, it's brand new. It was never driven. It was driven by an old lady, right? And it's a lie. And you're lying to people on a daily basis. And she said, look, I mean, those people come here to be lied to, right? They know that they cannot afford a car in good state, and they just want you to tell them a story so that they can feel good. So if you are an investor who would prefer to hear the perfect story versus knowing exactly how things are, that might be a problem for you, right? But that's not an investor I think you want. You want people who will kind of get into that relationship with open eyes and then will be willing to work with you on the things that you need help with. So it's not always, you might lose deals because of that, but I would argue that those are deals that you probably don't want to get anyway.
I see that partially as an issue with first-time founders, especially because, and I guess we as media are part of the problem. They focus so much on fundraising, on the fundraising part. Somehow, you know, the doing business part becomes secondary in their head. And they would fundraise from anyone. There is so much focused on who has money, and they don't even know how to differentiate between the different funds. They just hope that whoever they actually pitch to, if it's an angel, VC fund, private equity, they would just pitch to anyone. And they would actually rather hope that, yeah, we're going to receive the money, and that's actually, you know, the big success of it all.
I really appreciate people who are very good at that, right? But I think the aura around fundraising, it needs to go down a little bit. Because right now, first of all, if you are a bootstrapped company and you've never even had to take financing, that's much better than securing a $100 million investment, right? And we have companies like SiteGround, for example, that have had huge success, but because they never raised any money, they're kind of not getting the same limelight as some of the other ones, which is, I believe, unfair. Because if you can build an amazing company with no outside help, that's great. That's amazing feat. At the same time, it's an easy measure. And I understand why it is. And it's not easy to do. And the companies that are good at fundraising are able to do amazing things in big markets. Because IT technology is an expensive industry. And it's not easy to lift yourself by the shoestrings. So I hear what you're saying. It is an accomplishment. It's not easy to do. It's an important part of your company, but there are other things to look at. This cannot be the be all and all of, mm-hmm. of everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. at the end of the day, what product you put out, what problem you solve. There are a lot of companies that don't have a lot of financial success, but they're solving really, really important problems. Mm-hmm. There are companies that have built amazing teams and have created a lot of quality of life for the people in them. Granted, that's probably a small accomplishment, but it's still an accomplishment, you know?
Yeah.
So I think people just need to look at more factors when they evaluate what a successful company is.
Of course, it's much more complex. What I find interesting about Plan Delta is that you also managed to fundraise from 17 business angels. Yeah. I mean, that's a crazy amount of business angels. Was that strategic, or were you just so desperate to get money? I don't know what happened there.
No, we were oversubscribed, to be honest. We had more cash, and at some point we had to trim down the size of the tickets for the angels. It's two things. First of all, having good angels investors is amazing, because as somebody said, it's the unique opportunity to have somebody pay you to work for you. Right, because they give you money and then you go out to them and they help you with advice, they help you with connections, etc. So it's kind of a backward idea, but it's great. You usually have to give somebody money for them to work for you. We had the luxury of having a great network of people around us that were extremely useful in different areas of the business that we were not necessarily super good at, things like sales, marketing, international relationships, etc. And we were like, we got a list of about 20 people. We said, hey, if we can get any of them to be angels, that would be great, because that will help company a lot. And we'll be able to share this journey with people that we love, with people that we have a lot of respect for. And we started doing the angel pitches towards the end of our fundraising when we've gotten pretty good at it. Mm. So our angel pitch was actually pretty convincing. An angel pitch is usually shorter than a VC pitching process, right? They won't spend like 2 weeks to vet you. You gotta make a really strong impression in the first hour. Mm-hmm. And we had a great first hour. I think it's more of a testament to our pitching skill that we got so many people to come on board. But it's also great for the company. It's now we have, there's literally no area that we cannot reach out to an angel and get some help. So it ended up great.
I find it also interesting that you have an angel investor who is already part of a unicorn company. So
true.
They yep. also bring the experience of what is it to scale really, really fast. Yeah.
Yeah.
And really, really high.
Really, really happy. Konstantin from PayHawk is one of them.
How do you manage the process so that you can actually get most of their advice and connections? And I guess in a way, it is maybe not a one-person job, like a full-time job to manage the angels, but still, it is a very conscious process. Mm. Yeah.
There are two aspects to that. One is just general investor relationship, and we found some good practices along the way because we had a lot of people that are part of boards, etc., and they gave us some playbooks that were very useful, because you want to keep all of your investors in the know of what's happening. They shouldn't mm-hmm. be the ones asking questions. If somebody's reaching out to you about it for information about how the company's going, you're not doing a good job mm-hmm. of how you communicate with that. So we started doing, so as far as the information flowing from the company to them about how things are going, we ended up with this good process that we send this regular newsletter, so we let them know. When we need help for them, then it's a much more informal process. We have owners for pretty much everything in the company. So if it's a technological issue, it will be me who will reach out to somebody and say, mm-hmm. hey, we need help with this, this, and this. So this is not that formal. It's basically when we need to solve something and we need help with something.
Mm-hmm. I also expect that their expectations towards how you report to them are higher because you're after
the professional angel
you should
recruiting.
Be. So I guess it's also a test of your own software.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
It was actually, this is actually one of the cases that we we sell to other people, so we gotta be pretty good at it. I mean, we're saying, hey, you want an easy way to report to your stakeholders, you report to your fund, right? Mm-hmm. Plan Delta is the tool. So
yeah. Amazing. Okay. How is it going? What is the path that you see now ahead? So you've reached a certain point. Are you confident that you're at the product market fit right now, or are you okay?
Yeah, I mean, our system has at least 3 or 4 modules that are separate and bring their own individual value. Mm-hmm. We believe now we are at an excellent product market fit for the first of it, and it's kind of incremental. And you have the first, and then the second sits on top of it, and then the third sits on top of the first two. So we are in a pretty good place on our first module. We are having good traction now in the market with it. We are working on the product market fit for the second module.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that there is a third and a fourth after that. So mm-hmm. it's going to be a pretty long marathon for us. The good part is, stage one can be a pretty good sustainable business on itself, so we wouldn't be in a position where we'll have to necessarily reach the stage four to be a viable company. So that's what we're trying to find a balance on, between making sure we build sustainable business on each step of the way that we get to before pushing hard for the next. Because you mm-hmm. can try and do everything, but you're going to run out of money somewhere in the process. We cannot be on an 8-year development cycle to get where we need to mm-hmm. go. So that was part of our early decision, was to break this down into individual things that can be sold on its own and that can validate that we are going on the right track still.
I remember a conversation with Sutsok Yugiev, Telerik, and I think that was the most kind of like valuable piece of advice that he gave us. He is not an angel, but we actually had like 1 or 2 mentor sessions with him. And this is what I learned, actually, what is strategy in this kind of development. So you lay the foundation of the next stage. You yeah. prepare, so you put an order of how you build your portfolio and how do you build your product or your service in a way that the previous stage is like the foundation for the next yeah. stage, and then you go like this, and you don't shoot at once in all directions. You just think, okay, so if I do this, it's going to make my next module easier. And then yeah. the second module is going to make my third module easier, and so on and so forth.
That's the ideal structure, yeah. yeah. And so we got a pretty similar, we were very lucky, because Vasco Terziev, our esteemed mayor, was mm-hmm. our first board member from 11 side, and now Svetozar is our mm-hmm. board member. And one of the, I mean, they gave us probably 150 great advice, but one of the things that really was not that obvious to us is they told, look, I mean, you can sell anything on a presentation. You can sell anything by just explaining what it is, right? Mm-hmm. And if somebody has interest in it, they will buy it, right? They're not going to give you money at that point, but they say, I need that.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't necessarily have to have your product ready to ship to understand mm-hmm. if you have a fit. And that's a huge mind shift, because a lot of people that are, especially in the software space, they have this kind of a, if you build it, they will come, right? I don't know if you saw the movie. I mean, the idea is that you build a stadium and people will somehow learn about it and come to it. But this never happens, right? And if you go through that approach and you spend all the resources and you invest in it, and then nobody comes, then you're dead. It's much easier to have that conversation as early as possible. Maybe it's just a word, a verbiage. Maybe it's a wireframe. Maybe it's a non-functional prototype, right? And you can get a lot of feedback from the market. And the earlier stage you do that, the less wrong steps you're gonna make.
I've been observing this phenomenon with a couple of companies that I've talked to, and they would reflect only after mm-hmm. that, yeah, we did it the wrong way. We started developing the product without actually talking to the market. And just like so many others, we invested in perfecting something that actually no one needed.
Yeah.
And the theory is out there, and it's a universal truth, especially in our startup bubble, where we're reading the same books and we're talking the same truths to each other, and still this is happening again and again and again. And I wonder if there is some kind of like a psychological reason for that, like, I don't know, some weird imposter syndrome where especially technical people and engineers prefer to be really, really prepared before they start talking to someone. Is it something that you tackle in a different way? Because obviously the theory is not solving this issue.
Yeah.
Why is this?
It's a bit of an ego problem too, because in one case you say, oh, I have the perfect picture, right? I know exactly what it's going to be. And I love when people say, well, Steve Jobs didn't ask people what they want. Like, really, you and Steve Jobs kind of in the same sentence, right? You are like the parallel to that. I mean, that's an outlier. That's a huge, huge exception to the rule. And it usually, obviously, it's more rewarding for you to be the visionary that sees what nobody else sees. But that's why 90% of the startups fail. If you are able to like decrease your ego a little bit, go out to the client, understand what they want, there's still a ton of creativity to do afterwards in how you deploy it to them. But some people find it less rewarding, I think, to ask, right, for directions. There are people, you know, that people, when they travel, they never ask for directions and they stay lost. I mean,
I remember that from the books about the difference between men and women, that men just don't feel
right. And you know that, I mean, it's great that there are now a lot more female founders, but there's still a lot of men founders. So I think that's in play, because obviously a lot of the, like, big egos is not uncommon in people that are in entrepreneurship, right? And I think at some point you would prefer to be right than to ask questions. So it's a question. Do you want to be successful or do you want to have a big ego? It's one of the two. You cannot have both, usually. And I believe I'm now at a point that if something helps me to get the right product market fit, I don't care. I have zero problems telling I'm wrong, that I made wrong. Absolutely no problem.
How do you keep your personal ego in check as a CTO?
I think after being hit so many times, I don't have any. It's just, again, it goes back to that. Do you want to be successful? Because if you want to be successful, I don't think the ego is a tool. If you only want to take with you the things that help you go further. You don't want to bring over stuff that's hindrance. And ego is a hindrance. It's hindrance with working with other people. It's bad when you have to take ideas from your team, from everybody. It's a factor. If you take it out of the equation completely, it's much better. And I've decided that I don't need it. So I believe I'm now at a point that has very little impact on what I'm doing. At the end of the day, if you want to build your ego with something, it's success. If you have success, you're entitled to an ego. If you don't have success, based on what? Right? I mean,
okay. Oh, well, ego and arrogance are different. So I think ego is also necessary for you to want to be successful. So the ambition comes pretty much from ego. So I think there is like ego that is healthy, that is actually serving you. And there is the ego part, which is standing in your own way.
Yeah, I agree. Ambition is different. I'm still incredibly ambitious. Yeah, when I talk, maybe it's more of an arrogance. Maybe it's more about your self-importance and how important do you see of yourself being. That's something that I think is mostly a hindrance. But you got to have energy. I mean, startups run on the energy of the founders. That's the biggest currency. And people talk a lot about running out of money. That's usually secondary. Usually startups fail because the founders and the core people, they just lose the will to push forward. You gotta have that. You gotta have an unlimited supply of that. You gotta be able to have a horrible day and then come up the next morning with the same amount of energy that you had the previous day. Because even if you lose 1% of energy, then in 100 days you're done, right? That's the hardest part. It's like running full speed into a wall, slamming yourself in the wall, getting up and being absolutely as ready to do it again. It's almost like a mental condition that's not particularly healthy. Like... But it's as rewarding as anything else. I mean, it's the biggest pleasure you can get out of work that I've had in my life.
Mm. You mentioned before that, okay, you're now ready with the first module and there is a market for it. And now you're working on the product market fit of the second module, and then there comes a third and then the fourth. How do you prepare for this kind of marathon in your head?
It's very easy if you get into it with the right expectation from the beginning. And we did. We knew there was going to be a long run. It was hard for the VCs. Because we said, no, we are not. I mean, they said, okay, so are you going to be ready for our next round? I mean, what's your ARR going to be in 1 year? So we're going to have zero ARR in 1 year because we are not going to be ready. But they are big wins that you can get relatively simple, but that's already been attacked. If you want to reach for some very high goals, the ones that are mostly available are the ones where it's hard. The reason why there are not 100 companies doing it is because it's not easy, right? If it was easy, I mean, we are talking about like maybe 20 companies are attacking this space, but that's a relatively low number. If it was something that was easier to do, that would be 1,000 companies attacking the space.
How competitive is the space that you're currently in? I mean, again, I guess they are, you know, the big players who are serving the big enterprise customers, but you decided to put yourself in a different niche. So in the niche that you, where you're in, who are the competitors?
So there is companies like Anaplan, who has been on the market for like 25 years. They have 1,000 customers, but their customers are Ford, Coca-Cola, like the biggest enterprise in the world. Average ticket, $300,000 a year.
But I guess their solution could be a bit too complex for
it's
niche
not
that you're in. It's not, you know, banging with a hammer on, I don't know.
Or a really small thing, on the other end of the spectrum, there are tools like LifePlan, who charge $12 a month, but they have presumably about 800,000 users. So it's a very wide array of planning tools from the, and obviously the oldest incumbents are in the upper market because that's the more lucrative space. It's much easier to do it there. And newer players are kind of starting from the middle and trying to raise up. There is a big cohort of tools that started around 4 or 5 years ago. All of them have been incredibly well-funded, right? Incredibly well-funded. And it's a race. And we believe we have a different approach to them, that we think it's better. They think it's not. So we'll see. I mean, we are different enough to either be right or be right for a segment of the market that's big enough for us to make it worth it. Right?
Yeah, I can imagine that there is also space. It's a huge market here that we're talking about. And still, when it comes to companies who have a longer R&D process like you, how do you manage to still get the investors on board? Because the way that the VC industry is structured right now, it would naturally prefer companies who have shorter R&D periods and incubation and so on and so forth, especially in our region, by the way.
It's a challenge. And I wish we started like 3-4 years earlier so we can get that that big boom in that. Because then the companies that were in our shoes, they pretty much said, look, I mean, we need $200 million to get this done. And people were saying, okay, sure, yeah, here's $200 million investment. And they have this money now, and we are trying to work against them with our 2 million round, and it's a tough fight.
But why didn't you ask for 200 million?
Well, we did.
We were already talking to the big ones. What?
We did, but we missed the train by a little bit.
Okay.
I don't know if we would have gotten it if we did it a couple of years ago, but we had a small chance. It's not very easy for a company in Bulgaria to, I think, get those very early huge rounds. I think companies like Payhawk and some of the others have opened the door for the opportunity of a company being big from here, but you still got to prove your traction a little bit. I don't think a Bulgarian company will soon get a, I don't know, 50 million pre-seed round. That's probably not going to happen anytime soon. And companies in France, in the UK,
and you believe that this is because we are missing the traction of successful companies who can actually operate with this kind of money and they're going to make like a big hit, big success?
I think it's a growing process, right? I mean, at some point there will be a fund that has $600 million and they can decide to put a big chunk of that into an early round because they see an amazing opportunity, right?
Mm-hmm.
The way it's currently structured is that the VC funds have pretty clear limits of what their rounds are going to be like. And I understand them because that's the size of rounds that actually makes sense in 95% of the cases. Mm-hmm. But let's say somebody comes in and comes up with the next open AI, right? This whole $100 billion idea. And they need $10 billion $1 billion investment to start it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to do it from our local infrastructure.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely, I mean, it's, look, I mean, I've been around for 20 years and what we have now is amazing compared to, I mean, the ecosystem has grown so much mm-hmm. in the last 10 years and we are super lucky. I mean, we're benefiting a ton from that. But there's still a long way to go. I mean, we're not done. One day it will be possible. So mm-hmm. that's not something to complain about. It's just more work to be done.
It's a maturation process, the way that I see it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But I still find it quite exciting when I get the chance to talk to one of those moonshot investors mm-hmm. who, because they have a very, very different mindset.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't think that at this point we also have the VCs who can tap into this kind of mindset. They're operating under different circumstances with different LPs, with different expectations, and they need to report to someone else as well.
Sure.
Okay. What is the thing that you mentioned the energy supply that is needed for an entrepreneur to run this long distances and still not lose, you know, get the hits, mm-hmm. deal with the challenges, and still wake up in the next morning and come back to office or, I don't know, to the Zoom call with the same level of energy. You mentioned that this supply needs to be a sort of an infinite, but I don't believe that this is how it works. We charge this supply.
Yeah,
so
true.
Which are the things that charge your supply of optimism and energy,
yeah.
enthusiasm?
I've thought a lot. You're absolutely right. It's not that it's an infinite, it's absolutely very finite. It's, as you know, by the end of each day, you're pretty much at the end of it.
And because we see founders still burning out,
all the time.
I don't think that we talk about it enough. So I'm sorry, that's like a personal thing mm-hmm. That I have. We are, especially in the media, spreading this, idea that founders are these special creatures, yeah? And they were born with something that others people don't have. They're unique in their own way. And this energy supply is somehow magically happening until, and you believe that as a founder, until you kind of like hit the wall and you find yourself in the first burnout and then in the second and in the third. So if you talk to experienced founders, you would actually know the dark side of entrepreneurship, which we don't talk about enough.
For me, I mean, it cannot be success, right? Because you are not going to get success for a long period of time, right? If you're counting on that to be your driver, you're going to be in a bad place. I have two main ones. I hate failing so much that it actually charges me. So the idea that something is going to fail is pissing me off very hard, and it's a huge motivator. But I also get pretty motivated. It's not that I haven't. I mean, me and a friend created a car rental service the year before COVID hit. That didn't go very well, but there wasn't much I can do there. But like hating failure is important, and you can hate failure every day, right? There's no limit to how much you can do that.
Okay.
And the possibility of success, not success, but the opportunity for success is, I think, also a big driver. And you can also have an opportunity for success at all times. So even though you don't have success today, you know that it's out there, you know the path to it, you can see it. Okay. And that helps.
Do you visualize it in a certain situation, like the opportunity of success? Do you, some people, they have this too, it's called visualizing, where you kind of like imagine it in the most detailed way that you can.
I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah. I do the opposite. I mean, what I do is I visualize failure a lot. And it's a great way to make decisions because people are scared by a lot of things that they shouldn't be scared about. And the reason they're scared by them is because they don't go through the exercise of knowing exactly what it will be.
Sometimes actually the scariest fears are the abstract ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how I made all the hard decisions in my life. Because at one point I had to leave my cushy corporate job and start a startup with no financial backing, with no clear indication how it's going to go. And what helped me the most was I literally went through the exercise of, okay, what's going to be the worst case scenario, right? And the worst case scenario was that in 2 months, I'll sit with those guys that I respect a ton with my team. I'll tell them that we have to close shop. I have to probably sell my apartment, go back to my parents, right? That was like, that's pretty bad in my book. But mm-hmm. that was the worst that could happen. I'm not going to be on the street. I can still take care of my family, right? Mm-hmm. And you said, okay, I can live with that. I mean, that's not good. I don't want to get there, but it's not that bad. I mean, there's definitely worse than that. And now you can push forward knowing that whatever happens, you're kind of at peace with the worst possible scenario. Mm-hmm. So I don't mind having success be more abstract, but I think you need to have failure be not abstract at all so that you know you can live with it. I mean, in some cases, the answer might be no, I cannot live with that. So then don't do it. Don't go there. So it's a great story. We were at this event in Munich, Bits and Pretzels. So one of the speakers there was one of the original co-founders of Klarna. And what this guy was talking about, because he never had money in his life, right? He started as a student and then he founded Klarna and they didn't have any salaries for first 6 years. And they at some point, very late, who is like, she was like 32, basically with no money, with no time to do things he loves. And they finally got the big money and he was able to, you know, pay himself a $12 million bonus. Mm. And he went to Vegas and he partied for a week and then came back and went into rehab because he was with severe depression. Because after all he did, he thought there would be more at the end of it, right? He thought that, like, for me to make that sacrifice, I would feel absolutely amazing. And he was shocked to find that sometimes you don't feel that amazing, that you still think about the next problems that you're having, etc. And he literally broke down and went through some really tough times. And now he's doing something different when he's funding companies that are for profit but have very strong social agenda and things that are making good in the society. And said, that's what I found my inspiration on. But I definitely think that should be more of a topic, because if you want to go into this world, you got to know that it's not just flowers and roses, right? I mean, we talk a lot, obviously, and it's normal to talk about successful cases.
Yeah.
But we got to talk about the bad times of the successful cases, and we got to talk about the people that just didn't quite make it, because there is a huge amount of chance in all of this. And I really appreciate when somebody, there was this great interview by Mark Cuban, he said, look, same guy, same education, same skills. If I was born 2 years earlier, I wouldn't have any success. So I might be flipping burgers somewhere. Mm-hmm. So it's not just skill. There are a lot of other factors, and you shouldn't be evaluating yourself based on that. But that's not, I mean, here's an interesting thing. I was listening a few days ago to Show Must Go On by Queen, and it's a song about a guy that's terminally ill. But there are a lot of like founder-related quotes that you can find in there, right? You know, inside my heart is breaking, my makeup may be flaking, but my smile still stays on because the show must go on. And it's a harrowing thought that like something that's written for somebody that's almost dead can have that much impact on the way you feel from time to time. So it's important to talk about it. I don't think the goal is to discourage people from doing that. But as with everything, you got to go into it with open eyes and know exactly what you're getting yourself into.
I think it's pretty similar to what you're trying to give to businesses. At the end, we don't want, especially when things are going well, heart, you don't want to look at your finances, because the picture that you're going to find is not flowers and roses.
True.
And it's only natural, especially for optimistic founders, to be, I don't want to, you know, look in, into that. I don't want to, you know, structure it. And at the same time, if you start reading the signs as early as possible, then at least you can take actions. You can prepare yourself. And I think it's the same with mental health. It's like managing your financial wallet, but here you're managing a wallet of energy that, it's, and the more conscious we are about it, the more we can see the early signs, the more we can start preparing, and the more we can also tap into strategies of how are we going to manage that and how are we going to spread it in the right places. Yeah. So it is a similar thing.
It's a big, it's your biggest resources. And to be honest, people were asking us a lot, like, well, things are kind of in a little bit of a recession state. How does that impact your business? And it does impact our business, but it actually, it has a positive and a negative. The positive side of that is that right now it's very relevant for everybody to have a good track of their financials.
I was just thinking that maybe the way that you're going to be growing is kind of like, what is the word, like anti-cyclic to the economy?
It is anti-cyclic. It's good because it's not only anti-cyclic, but once you get a recession and you see that things cannot be perfect at all times, there is probably 5 or 6 years afterwards that you're still kind of this is at the back of your mind and say, well, things are going well right now, but it's not forever.
Mm-hmm.
So this is good for us. I mean, every time we go to these investor meetings, et cetera, everybody's saying, have a good look at your finance, be mindful of what you're doing. I said, well, we are the tool for that, so it's great. Even when times are good, if you know that times could be bad, you'll start to think more about it. I mean, this is probably, last year was probably the first year in about 20 years that was not a booming year for the IT industry. Some people thought that it was always going to be like that. And I think it was bad for a lot of businesses. A lot of people lost their jobs, and that's sad. But the perspective that it doesn't always go up is important. And the way you ensure that when it starts not going that well, that you address it. It's the same with the burnout. You don't want to be addressing it when you're burned out. You want to know that you're getting there. And that's what, Plan Delta is the financial equivalent of your psychiatrist that tells you that you're close to a burning out point. It's actually a great time for us to push that message in.
Mm-hmm. Relate to what you're saying. I remember my first entrepreneurship or my first attempt as an entrepreneur. I was just about to quit my job and, you know, start something new. And then I went to a fellow entrepreneur and I asked him, hey, I'm super scared. What do you do? Like, what do you tell yourself? And he asked me one question, and that was it. Okay, if it fails, what's the worst thing that can happen?
It's a great exercise.
Actually, it's not that bad. I mean, I remember back then I told him, you know what, I won't be able to pay the rent of my apartment. And I'll have to, I don't know, I wouldn't have a space to live. And he's like, okay, you're going to come on my couch. Not so bad, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think the more you make it tangible, the less, or the better you can decide if you can live with it or not.
Mm-hmm.
It can be still scary. The worst case scenario.
People are very scared of like some numerically estimated things going down. Like salary is one thing, right? Mm-hmm. People are like, oh, what I'm going to do is like my salary goes down. I went from a very high US-based company corporate salary to $1,000 a month. And I was on that for maybe a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And it was perfectly fine.
It can be also very refreshing, by the way. For me, it's very freeing knowing that I actually need much less. I don't need all the stuff that I'm surrounding myself with.
And I knew that I could do without them. I just didn't. I was surprised by how little I cared by not getting them. Because I was actually living the best time of my life, right? I was having so much fun working for myself, working for the people in my team that I loved. Because I was in that structured corporate thing that didn't bring me any joy for the last 5-10 years. I was not growing. I was not doing anything different. I was pretty happy, right? So if you are doing something you love, that's not a problem. Like you can get almost zero money and be okay. If you're not doing something you love, the amount of money that it takes to get you to an even point is actually pretty high. So that's the only thing. Are you going to be happy if you go that path? If you do, everything is going to sort itself out.
Mm-hmm.
And you're surprised how many people will come and help you out, right? If you are in this position and you're doing something that you believe in and you're doing something you love, people will come out of the woodwork and help you out. Surprising. It's very good. It's great. It's a great feeling.
Did you have mentors along the way?
Oh yeah, a ton. I mean, I don't like the official stating of somebody as your mentor, right? I don't think that you gotta appoint somebody to be your mentor. You gotta be open to learning from everybody in your life. But obviously there were certain people in my life that had a bigger impact. I was pretty lucky because the first company, the US company that I joined, I was kind of in a team lead position. I had a little bit of management experience, but I was pretty new. I was 24 years old. And I got a chance to work with hardcore serial entrepreneurs from the Silicon Valley, right? Our CEO at the time, it was his sixth company. He had five very successful exits. So I got thrown out like right in the deep end. And those guys were gods in the beginning, right? The things that they have accomplished, the knowledge they had. And I learned a ton. The first 4 or 5 years were absolutely amazing. And then at some point, as you grow, you start getting better in some things than them. And that was a crisis at some point because you said, wow, this guy's making a mistake now and I know a better way to do it. So mentors shouldn't be gods, right? I mean, those are people that you learn from them, you learn as much as you can. They are as flawed as any other person. And if you're good and if you're growing, at some point you'll get to that level and you shouldn't be afraid of that. At that point, you just need to find some other guys to learn from. It's just surround yourself with smarter people than you are, right? And if you, that's a pretty cliche thing, but it's right. If you are the smartest person in the room, find another room.
Yeah.
Unless it's a lifestyle thing, unless you're just looking for a comfy place to just feel good in. But if you want to grow, I love to see inspirational tales from other areas. And I read the biography of Gordon Ramsay, and it's pretty great case because he was in a position to have his own restaurant in London, right? He was offered to be the head chef. But instead of becoming the head chef and getting the big salary and the recognition, he went to France and worked for 3 years in the lowest possible position but in the best kitchens. So mm-hmm. He switched from a very, very good restaurant to like the absolute top of the chain, but he literally started like peeling carrots and slicing things and doing the lowest level work. And that's why I think he's probably one of the greatest chefs in the world right now. Because mm-hmm. if you, at some point you become complacent, and at point you become complacent, your growth is done. You're not going to grow anymore. So you can't afford to become complacent unless you've reached the absolute top of your game, if you want to get there, right?
True. That's actually very wise. I'm thinking that also the better you get, the harder it is to find the next
room. Oh yeah, absolutely.
Especially in our part of the world, because you know, at some point there are only so few people who are successful or more successful than you are, and then you need to continue and you need to find the next examples.
But you can always switch the topic. I mean, if you're at that point, if you're at the top of your game, switch the topic. Go to something else. You'll be at the bottom of the chain again. if that's what you want, if you want to climb that ladder again, it's so easy.
It gives you pleasure. Yeah. Milan, thank you so much. I'm actually very impressed by how reflective you are on certain topics and how much wisdom is there in what you're saying. I think would like to continue the conversation, but I just don't want to keep you for the next 3 hours. I think this kind of podcasts, which are now 3 hours plus, are hard to digest, especially by other founders who appreciate their time so much. So I'm going to stop it here. But I would like us, you know, to maybe repeat the conversation a couple of years when we have tested also certain hypotheses. And I'm sure that you will have, again, a very interesting perspective on things. It's amazing how much wisdom you have managed to collect only so far.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for this conversation and also for your honesty here. I think, I enjoy it when people actually kind of like speak sincerely about the experience and they're not trying to fluff it and make it prettier as it is.
And if you're just as passionate about innovation as we are, hit subscribe for the Recursive Podcast on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform. We're everywhere. This podcast episode is supported by EBRD. Support to small and medium-sized businesses is an important part of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development's mandate. Activities to support small businesses include direct and indirect financing through partner institutions. The EBRD's Advice for Small Businesses team provides the knowledge, the network, and the skills to help emerging businesses innovate, thrive, and succeed.